Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good morning, Ramona Koval here with The Book Show, and you're on ABC Radio National. Today, Armistead Morpan from the Brisbane Writers' Festival speaking to me about his new book, Michael Tolliver Lives. And we're continuing our first-person reading of Unpolished Gem by Alice Pung, her account of growing up as a child of Indochinese refugees. But first, listeners to The Book Show yesterday might remember the conversation I had about blogging and online literary conversations. And the BBC runs a few of these, one devoted at the moment to the worst song lyrics in history. The problem with this is, of course, that what you think you hear is usually not what is written, given the terrible enunciation of most rock singers. So it sounds silly, but it's usually slightly less silly once you see the words written out. But here are a few anyway, and Sir Paul McCartney, MBE, comes in for a drubbing on a couple of accounts, like "In this ever-changing world in which we live in," or "In which we're living," depending on what you can hear. One writer says that he's never seen so many redundant words in one sentence. And then there's "Then someone finally came. He told me he loved me. I put him off with lies. He could see I had no eyes," from "I'm Still Waiting" by Diana Ross. Sounds like one of those horrible fish that live in the deep seas beyond all light. Not exactly Cole Porter, are they? But I must disagree with one blogger who names Queen's "Scaramouche, Scaramouche, Will You Do the Fandango" as some of the worst lyrics in history. The lyrics might be silly, but what a fantastic song. And now to American writer Armistead Morpan. He's the author of 9 novels, including Maybe the Moon and The Night Listener, but he's best known for his 6-volume Tales of the City series, which began life as a column in the San Francisco Chronicle, and which, between 1976 and 1989, chronicled the tangled lives of a group of characters centred around that city's colourfully bohemian gay scene. After 18 years, Morpan has returned to Barbary Lane with a new book, Michael Tolliver Lives, which is another love song to his adopted home. And San Francisco returned the compliment. Earlier this year, Mayor Gavin Newsom declared that June 12th was Michael Tolliver Day in San Francisco. Tolliver was, of course, the beloved hero of the Tales of the City series, a man who's been living with AIDS for a long time now. The book begins with Michael being greeted by a man he passes in the street who says, "You're supposed to be dead." The man is someone whose face Michael doesn't recognise, but turns out to be the owner of a penis that he remembers fondly, or describes floridly, actually, from something referred to as a circle jerk in the 1970s. So Michael Tolliver has survived with AIDS into his late 50s, and he's even fallen in love and married his much younger husband, Ben. Here, from the Brisbane Writers' Festival last Sunday afternoon, is Armistead Morpan. And just a warning, there is sexually explicit language and adult themes in what you're about to hear.
I met him on the internet. Well, not exactly. I saw him on the internet and met him on the street in North Beach. But I would never have known who he was, or rather what he was looking for, had my friend Barney not modeled for a website catering to older gay men. Barney is 48, a successful mortgage broker and something of a muscle daddy. He's a wee bit vain, too. He could barely contain himself when he stopped me on Market Street one day to tell me that his big white marble ass was now available to worldwide wankers for only $21.95 a month, credit card or online check. Once upon a time, this would have struck me as sleazy, but the internet has somehow persuaded half the world to get naked for the enjoyment of the other half. Barney is a fairly sexy guy, but I squirmed a little when I checked out his photos on the site. Maybe I've just known him too long, but there was something incestuous and unsettling about it, like watching your Aunt Gladys flashing titty for the troops. At any rate, there was a personal section on the website, so once I'd fled the sight of Barney's winking sphincter, some parts I just can't get through. Last year, my friend Ian McKellen revised his show, A Night Out, in which he reads from various, extremely varied works of literature, and he asked me if he could have something from the new book, so I gave him this passage. And you really haven't lived until you've heard the world's greatest actor intone the words, "Bonnie's winking sphincter." He told me not too long ago that when we retire, we should open a pub called the Winking Sphincter. So, once I'd fled the site of Barney's Winking Sphincter, I checked out the guys who were looking for sex, friendship, or long-term relationships. There were lots of geezers there, by which I mean anyone my age or older. Regular Joes from Lodi or Tulsa, smiling bravely by their vintage vehicles or dressed for some formal event. Most of them offered separate close-ups of their erections, artfully shot from below, so that doubtful browsers could find their way past the snow on the roof to the still raging fire in the furnace. What surprised me, though, was the number of young guys on the site, guys in their 20s or 30s specifically looking for partners over 45. The one who caught my attention and held it, clean-cut lad for you, was a sandy blonde with a brush-cut and shining brown eyes. His actual name was not provided, but his profile identified him as 33 and versatile, a resident of the Bay Area. He was lying against a headboard, smiling sleepily, a white sheet pulled down to the first suggestion of pubic hair. For reasons I still can't name, he came across like someone from another century, a stalwart captured on daguerreotype, casually masculine and tender of heart. So how did this work? Did I have to submit a profile, or could I just email him directly? He'd want to see a photo, wouldn't he? Would I have to get naked? The young can keep a little mystery, it seems to me, but the old have to show you their stuff, which, of course, is easier said than done. Sure, the right dick can distract from a falling ass, and some people actually get off on a nice round stomach. But who has any use for that no man's land between them, that troublesome lower stomach of sloppy skin? Maybe I could pose in my dirty work clothes with just my dick hanging out. I could call myself nice and dirty for you. But who would take the picture? Barney was the logical choice, but I had a sudden gruesome flash of him directing my debut and thought better of it. Who was I kidding anyway? Clean-cut lad probably got hundreds of offers a week. It was wiser to stick to my monthly night at the Steamworks, where the goods were always on the table, and rejection, when it came, was instant and clean. And that's the way I left it, aside from printing out the guy's webpage and posting it above my potting shed. It stayed there for ages, curling at the edges, a pinup boy for a war that would never be waged. I might not have met him at all if my friend Anna Madrigal hadn't called to invite me to dinner at the Café Sport. The Café Sport is on Green Street, way across town in North Beach, a gaudy Sicilian cavern that dishes up huge, creamy mounds of seafood and pasta. Anna had been going there for 30 years and often used its peasanty charms as a way of luring me out of my complacent nest in the Castro. At 85, she was convinced I was growing too set in my ways. I needed some excitement, she said, and she was the gal to provide it. So there we sat, awash in colors and aromas, when the impossible happened. Anna was adjusting her turban at the time, consulting the mirror behind my back as she fussed with wisps of snowy hair, yet somehow she still caught the look on my face. "What is it, dear?" "I'm not sure," I said. "Well, you must have an idea." A cluster of departing diners had moved toward the door, obscuring my view. "I think I saw someone." "Someone you know?" "No, not exactly." "Someone you want to know." She shooed me with a large gloved hand. "Go on then, catch up with him." "I don't know." "Yes, you do. Get the hell out of here. I'll be here with my wine." So I sprang to my feet and shimmied through the tightly packed crowd. By the time I reached the door, he was nowhere in sight. I looked to the right toward the fog-cushioned neon of Columbus, then left toward Grand Avenue. He was almost at the end of the block and picking up speed. I had no choice but to make myself ridiculous. "Excuse me," I yelled, hurrying after him. No response at all. He didn't even stop walking. "Excuse me, and the blue jacket?" He stopped, then turned. "Yeah?" "Sorry, but I saw you at the restaurant and..." "Oh, shit. He reached reflexively for his back pocket. "Did I leave my wallet?" "No," I replied. "Just me." I had hoped that this would prove to be an icebreaker, but it landed with a dull thud, missing the ice completely. The guy just blinked at me in confusion. "I think I saw you on a website," I explained. Another blink. "Clean-cut lad for you?" Finally, he smiled. There was a fetching gap between his two front teeth, which only enhanced the fuckable Norman Rockwell image. "I could have sent you my profile," I told him, "but I figured it was easier just to chase you down the street." He laughed and stuck out his hand. "I'm Ben McKenna, Michael Tolliver. I saw you inside with that lady." He held my hand a little longer than actually required. "Was that your mother?" I chuckled. "Anna would love to hear that." "Not exactly," I said. "She looks interesting." "She is, believe me." We were rapidly veering off the subject, so I decided to take the bullock by the horns. "I have to get her home, as a matter of fact. Would you mind giving me your phone number? Or I could give you mine." He looked almost surprised. "Either way," he said with a shrug. We went back into the restaurant for pencil and paper. As Ben scribbled away by the cash register, I looked across the room and saw that Anna was watching this transaction with a look of smug accomplishment on her face. And I knew this would not be the end of it. Something this juicy could amuse her for weeks. "My, my," she said as soon as I returned. "I hope you carded him." "He's 33. Cut me some slack." "You asked him his age?" "I read it online." "Oh, brave new world," she intoned melodramatically. "Shall we head down to the park, dear, before we call it a night?" "Thought you'd never ask," I said. So I walked her down to Washington Square, where we sat in the cool, foggy dark and shared a quick doobie before bedtime.
Armistead Maupin, reading from his latest book, Michael Tolliver Lives, at the Brisbane Writers' Festival at the weekend.
The thing I'm thinking about listening to you, and the thing that came across to me was that is such a romantic scene. And it's kind of sleazy as well. I mean, the combination of romance and sleaze, I want you to talk about.
Well, that's me. that is me. I'm a deeply romantic guy, and I'm not afraid of sex. I love sex. I still love sex. And I've tried to celebrate both things. I've tried to let the romance of my work take the fangs out of the sex, if you will, and vice versa. I mean, that's what we have in life. Those two things are what keep us going as human beings, I think. Not so much sleaze, but sex, because I don't feel sleazy. Maybe I am, but I don't feel it. And it's kind of hard for that passage not to have romance in it, because it's, with the exception of the fact that Anna Madrigal wasn't there, that was actually the way I met my husband, Christopher Turner, who's over there in the corner right now, sitting next to the legend Tom Keneally, I'm very happy to say. The difference being that when I actually walked up to him and said that horribly embarrassing line of, "Didn't I see you on a website?" He said, "Actually, I own that website."
Daddyhunt.com.
Thank you very much. Daddyhunt.com. It's a family business now, so we appreciate your support. And actually, you know, Christopher's had this amazing vision, you know, because the men in the gay community, of course, are getting older. There's a lot of us who've been out of the closet for 30 years, and we spent the first third of our lives running scared and being alone, lonely and alone, and don't want to give that up.
But having a lot of fun as well as being lonely and alone and running scared.
Oh, well, I'm talking about, you know, for so many people of my generation, there was homophobia and the closet were running along side of all of that. You know, we had to be very careful. When I was first feeling sexual thoughts, what I was both a crime and a mental disease in the United States. So it's been a long journey, and I think we want our retirement to be happy and as pain-free as possible. And as I said in the book, there is one of the things that's not acknowledged in either the heterosexual or the homosexual community is to what degree there is serious attraction between younger and older people sometimes that is often written off as simply an exchange of power or money for youth and beauty when there's genuine mutuality there. I had the wonderful example of a mentor, Christopher Isherwood, who had a partner who was 30 years his junior, and they, to this day, they're still the most successful couple I've ever known. So it was not odd for me to accept this relationship when I realized how good it was.
This title, daddyhunt.com, I mean, what is it about the daddy part of it?
This is so funny. Sometimes I get asked to be a consultant on the oddest things. You know, when an American senator was caught in a public toilet 2 weeks ago, all the national media was calling me and saying, what is it about this foot under the stall thing?
I don't want to sound like that. But what I was asking really was about, I mean, you talked about the power relationships and whether it was about money and protection or whatever, but it's called daddyhunt.com.
Yeah, so
that's
interesting.
There's something about daddiness, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not in the strictest, people aren't looking for their fathers per se, but they're looking for mature men, older men that they relate to. And Chris would be the first to tell you, it's not just about that, it's also about older guys who want older guys, who want people their age. I'm not sure. It's a very difficult thing to explain, really, but it's just shorthand, really, for an intergenerational relationship.
And do you feel like you are in the fathering position all the time?
Oh, not at all. No, we take turns. I don't. You know, there's many of us were robbed of the sort of tenderness of an older man when we were growing up because men in most cultures don't know how to give that to each other. And I think there's a component there where that, you know, that's lost and people want it back to feel that kind of connection.
So
it's hard to analyze because nothing, you know, you can't put your finger on some things, but... But I think what Christopher intended, maybe I should just get him up here to explain the website. But what's interesting about that phrase is that's not old men, you know, looking for cute young guys. It's young guys who actually had to sort of come out of a second closet and acknowledge that they felt that attraction from a very young age. And they received judgment, not only about being gay, but about that thing itself.
Because there is this idea that youth and beauty is celebrated in the world at large and especially in gay culture.
And nothing else has any value. I've talked to a lot of women who say, oh, there should be a website like this for women. And last night I came up with the name cometomama.com.
Do you think there ever would be a website like that?
I know plenty. I mean, the first guy I came out to back in the late 60s in Charleston, South Carolina, was a really sweet guy who was a fellow reporter at the newspaper there. And when I came out to him, he said, I think I know something of what you must have gone through because my wife is 20 years older than I am, and I have never stopped being judged for that, and neither has she.
That line, that you're supposed to be dead, that really opens up a whole... part of the history of culture. When the plague came in the early 80s, and then people were dying, and sad, terrible things happened, and people who were HIV positive thought that this was going to be their future too.
Yes, I thought it about Michael Tolliver. I thought it about the character myself. In fact, people used to say to me, thank God you stopped writing Tales of the City because Michael would be dead by now. Then I fully thought when I ended the series in 1989, just as I thought this about every friend I had who was HIV positive, that he only had a few months or maybe years to go. That's really the reason I got back into the story, was the realization that a lot of people had been around for these 20 years, surviving, not in an easy way, because the meds that deal with HIV are quite debilitating. But they have been surviving, and they survived the homophobia of their youth, and they survived a plague which was laid at their doorstep, even when they were as ignorant as everyone else about what caused it or where it came from. And I wanted to celebrate those guys. I wanted to say, you know, bravo, you're heroes in my book, and this is my way of doing that. Michael Tolliver Lives has that additional meaning, as an addition to just a general message about getting older. I think it's really bad taste for a gay man of my generation to complain about getting old because I'm one lucky son of a bitch. Most of my friends didn't get to do it.
Armistead Maupin in conversation at the Brisbane Writers' Festival. You're listening to The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Ramona Koval.
I had a friend who was HIV positive in the mid-80s, and his response was that he just spent all his money going first class
And then he didn't die.
And then he didn't die. And then he had to think, well, what am I going to do now? I mean, how am I going to live and support myself and find a way to be who I am and keep living? And that must have been quite common.
Very common. And Michael says in the novel that the catch is that the longer you survive the disease, the closer you get to dying the ordinary way. And so the issues change. But yes, it was. There were a lot of people who really burned their bridges and then had a serious soul-searching to do in order to figure out where life was going to take them, because they'd counted on dying. Not didn't want to, but they'd taught themselves to accept that fact for a long time, and then it didn't happen.
The thing about nearly dying is that you learn how to not to fear death, but you also learn how to not to fear life either anymore.
Yes, well, I mean, there have been books written on the subject of how many spiritual discoveries were made as a result of AIDS. Don't run around saying, oh, isn't it wonderful this thing came along to give us this. And I certainly used to get very irritated at the sort of general attitude of the press that basically homophobically based, that said, well, I guess you guys have been taught a lesson now. You know, the party's over and you're really going to have to get it together. When in fact, there were already gay families in place to deal with this when the Holocaust arrived. I mean, they were... And the one thing that was fascinating to me at the time, or one of the many things that was fascinating, was the fact that lesbians stepped forward to care for the sick and the dying, and in a way that was extremely impressive, because up to that point there had been a certain amount of separatism, and we hadn't cared about each other to an intimate degree. I'm sure that there were places, for instance, where gay men were helping their friends who had breast cancer, say, but it was heart-rendingly beautiful in many, many ways.
You are very interested in this, in the social connections that get made out of this event. And really, I mean, this question about biological families and logical families. Mm. Can you talk a little bit about that?
That was one of those wonderful things that happens when you're in the middle of writing. I'd never run around saying my logical family as opposed to my biological family, but in the Michael Dolliver Lives, Michael is brought back to the bedside of his dying mother, who was a fundamentalist back in Florida, who, even after 30 years of knowing that her son is gay, still hasn't quite budged in her position on the subject. And he's feeling the frustration of knowing that all he's ever received is forgiveness, not acceptance. And that the family that he's made for himself back in San Francisco, of both gay and straight people and people of every generation, in the end is more important to him than the one that he was assigned. And this phenomenon, of course, is not really exclusive to gay people. Plenty of straight folks figure this out. And there's a sadness about that. There's a real sadness about it. You might go back to the bedside of a dying parent, but you don't really feel that connection, that intimacy that you feel with the people to whom you can open your heart and say anything. We're careful around our parents. I actually brought Christopher back to North Carolina. We were on the set of The Night Listener, the movie made out of my last novel. Mm-hmm. And my sister called and said that my 93-year-old father was probably close to death and that we should come back as soon as possible. So my father had not met Christopher, and I brought him back to Raleigh with me. And it was really quite lovely because the old man really rose to the occasion. And I think he loved having the company. I think he loved having men around that he could talk to or not be, he was so used to playing a role around family and women, and that it was useful to him. We drove around town and looked at some of the sites of his boyhood. He actually took us to the house where his father had committed suicide, I never was shown that house. I knew where it was, but I was never shown it as a boy. And I wrote about it in the Night Listener as a way of telling my father that I, you know, understood how this fit into his own life. And at the end of it all, he pulled Christopher aside and said, you take care of that boy. Hmm. And that he meant me. You know, this is a 90-year-old telling a 30-year-old to take care of a 60-year-old. And it was lovely.
Was he proud of you, your father?
He's always said that he was proud of me, and he I think he always has been. It didn't stop him from continuing to support the campaign of, say, Senator Jesse Helms, who's from my hometown and the most homophobic man in the United States. But he never, I'm sure there are plenty of people in this audience who know that same thing. You know, all other homos are bad, but the one in the family is fine. It's all those other fags we can't stand, you know.
Amistad Morpan talking about his latest book, Michael Tolliver Lives, at the Brisbane Writers' Festival over the last weekend. You're listening to The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Ramona Koval.
Michael Tolliver, do you think that he's, the society that he's living in now is a better place than it was, say, 30 years ago?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about that. We've seen a cultural revolution over the last 30 years, and it has been sort of, I mean, it was Anita Bryant, the singer in the States, who led the homophobic campaign in South Florida that really mobilized me and brought me out to my parents. I mean, I'd been out to people in San Francisco, but it was what brought it home for me. And then later on, I mean, eight or ten years ago when Matthew Shepard was murdered, it's usually some event that you're reacting against that brings into sharp focus exactly what sort of terror and oppression that gay people still live under. You never, ever, it never leaves you. I can sit here in a public gathering and talk very frankly about sex and my husband and my partner, and yet something is in the back of my head saying, be careful when I'm walking down the street with Christopher, because somebody might be looking who would yell something or take some violent action. It happens less and less, but it's still there. Gradually, the laws are changing in such a way that it's going to be harder and harder for people to do this, but still in the States, gay folks are treated by the religious right the way black people were treated 30 years ago. That's not acceptable anymore. They have to hide it. But homophobia is still acceptable. It's still a part of their Christian duty to endorse this sort of hatred. And I think that makes it harder, actually, for say, a 13 or a 14-year-old that's coming along and knows in their heart that he or she is gay, because their own family members are taking them to churches where they're preached against.
Well, this is why I really asked this question about whether, how much you think has changed, because now with the fundamentalist sweeping your country and many other countries in the world, things are kind of changing again.
Yeah, well, I think it's the last cry. I don't think they're going to get to do it much longer. I really don't. There are too many reasonable people out there, and that's why it's so important for gay people to be visible. That's why I'm very cross with gay people who've remained in the closet for a long time. I know celebrities, writers, people who've attended this very function who somehow don't think it's their responsibility to talk about their own homosexuality. They may have written about it in some way, but they don't address their own lives. And this is something where we really have to testify. We have to say, it's me. Ian McKellen came out in 1988, and he says that it was the result of a long night we spent over a bottle of champagne where I told him I felt it was his duty. I'm sure it was on his mind before then, but the way he did it was so brilliant, because he was, this was the time of Clause 28 in the UK, when they were putting down a law that said that the government couldn't lend state money to any art endorsing homosexuality, which, you know, pretty much threw out Shakespeare and Noel Coward and everybody else in between. And Ian was fed up with it, and he was on a panel discussion with the remarkably named Peregrine Wursthorn. If, you know, Dickens had to make up an idiot right-winger, it would be Peregrine Wursthorn. And he was, you know, thumping his chest all afternoon about these people, and finally Ian said, I tell you what, let's not talk about these people. Let's talk about me, because I'm one. And that was the way he did it. And that sort of sums up right there what everybody has to do.
Except that someone like Gore Vidal has always resisted this and has sort of said he doesn't want to be defined by where he chooses to ejaculate, basically.
Yes.
What do you think about that?
Tiresome.
Why? Why?
Because it's if it would be fine if it were the same thing, but we're not treated equally. And I frankly think Gore used it as an evasive technique for years. I interviewed him. He's a great man, don't get me wrong. And he's had some remarkable things to say in essays and that sort of thing. But he said there is no such thing as a homosexual. There's a homosexualist, someone who practices. Well, I mean, that's really, splitting hairs. When I interviewed him and he was running for the Senate, that's basically what he was trying to do. Don't make me say it. Don't make me say it. So finally, out of frustration, in the middle of this question and answer session, I said, so how long have you known Howard? Well, the man he had lived with for 35 years and he will be buried next to. And that's how we got into it. Because that's the essence of it. It isn't where you ejaculate, it's where your heart lies. It's who, you know, how you love.
I read a comment from the TLS that said, it is Maupin's Dickensian gift to be able to render love convincingly. That must have felt marvelous.
It actually came from Ed White, which made it even feel even better. I think that's what I've wanted. I don't know quite what he means by it, but I'm terribly flattered. I mean, I think I try to crawl inside the hearts of my characters, not just their heads, and maybe that's what he's referring to. And it's not hard to do. I mean, people say, oh my God, how did you write about a trans man? There's a character in Michael Tolliver Lives who's a female-to-male transsexual.
I was going to ask about her, him.
It's all right, I did the same thing. It does get confusing.
Because I've learned a lot from reading this book.
Well, I mean, that's
and I'm a grandmother.
I like that. Actually, grandmothers do know more, you know. People often say to me, oh, I can never let my grandmother see this. I think, come on.
Gee, I've
she
been
knows
on the
more than you do.
I've been on the net since I've read this. Because you said
Buck
thank
Angel?
You. Yes. I was a bit surprised. Do you want to tell us about your friend Buck Angel?
Buck Angel is a transgendered porn star who is a big, strapping, muscular, mustachioed, tattooed biker daddy who was born female and is proud of his vagina.
Do you think? I mean, the character in this book doesn't seem to be the same as the...
No. Well, that's one of the points I was making there. Everybody's different. But I was fascinated by Buck Angel because it's really confused gay men, because Buck Angel has shown up in a few sort of across-the-board gay porn movies, and suddenly there's Buck. And then, to the great disturbance of a lot of gay men, they're attracted. They go, I like those things
pecs.
Better than that's, I thought I did, you know? And it was wonderful. I guess it was on the start of the book tour in the States, and I called Christopher and got him on his cell phone in the Castro, and he said, you are not going to believe who I'm standing here with. I spotted Buck across the street, and I went over and introduced myself, and he Buck came and got on the phone and talked to me, and then we met him and his wife, a biological woman that he is married to, in Amsterdam, and had lunch with them, and I was impressed by him in the same way I was impressed by Tammy Dutrou, who was the inspiration for Maybe the Moon, who was the shortest woman in the world. I was talking to Tom, thrilled me earlier by saying that he liked that book so much. I like people who challenge my assumptions about things and who live their own lives, who say, this is who I am, and if you can't handle it, that's your problem, not mine. And the best indicator to me that there's something I should write about is something that makes me squirm. And that's what happened with Buck Angel. The first time I heard about it, I thought, what? And I spent an hour talking to him and saw what an extraordinary, kind, loving, great person he was and how much his wife loved him. And suddenly you're not thinking about plumbing anymore. You're just thinking about a human being who's sitting there.
Mm. Although there's a bit of... I mean, I must say to you that reading this, I had the feeling that
you know, the vulva wasn't exactly being celebrated in this book, because your character, who's based on Buck Angel, says that he's not going to take his trousers off because he doesn't like what's down there, just like the guy he's with doesn't like what's
well,
down
that's
there.
True, too. I mean, many trans men feel that their body's not right, so the part of them that doesn't fit with their vision of themselves is something they don't like. And, you know, and I have been, this is part of a whole discussion between Anna Madrigal, who, by the way, was extremely controversial when I put her into Tales of the City 30 years ago. The Chronicle, which is serializing the book, told me that I was not to let the public know that this woman had been born a man until at least a year went by.
What did that mean? Till they...
Because people would be made uncomfortable. The same way you're made uncomfortable by what is referred to as by Buck as his mangina.
Well, I wasn't... No, I'm used to that because I'm a grandmother and, you know... but I was really referring to a kind of ickiness in the text about the female form, I thought.
About
female genitalia. There was.
Well, I make fun of it on the part of Michael. I mean, he acknowledges it a kind of limitation. I mean, some gay men are prissy about that, as it were, you know. I mean, I think that's part of what I'm trying to do is to... And, you know, when Anna's talking to Michael, I mean, Michael's feeling very stodgy. And he says to her at one point, you know, all the modern everything there is, you know, I still don't quite know what a podcast is, for instance, or and the mangina thing.
But I didn't know what a circle jerk was.
Well,
so
there
we're
you go.
Even.
That's very old-fashioned, Ramona. That's what they did before the internet. Michael says to her, I just don't think I can keep up. And she says, you don't have to keep up, dear. You just have to keep open.
Armistead Maupin at the Brisbane Writers' Festival last weekend. His latest book is Michael Tolliver Lives, published by Random House. And that's part of the Tales of the City series, the latest one anyway. You're listening to The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Ramona Koval. And after 10 a.m. this morning, we'll find out how much of an impact the recent APEC gathering in Sydney had on the booksellers of the Harbour City from our regular guest Andrew Wilkins, who will be joining me with the latest news from the world of publishing. And he'll also tell us which world leader was spotted purchasing a copy of the book Nuclear Power is Not the Answer. And for about 200 million years, life forms existed without eyes. And then a single cell developed the capacity to distinguish between light and dark. And then British novelist and science writer Simon Ing says the fun began. So on that show, the history of the eye. And listeners in Sydney might like to know that later on Wednesday night at 6:30, I'll be in conversation at the Australian Hall in Elizabeth Street, Sydney, organised by Sydney Penn as part of its Three Writers project, with Gideon Haig, who's going to analyse Australia's nationalism, the good and the bad, and then talk to me. And the evening's going to be introduced by David Malouf. So that's later on tonight at 6:30 in Sydney. You can hear this program again by going to our website abc.net.au/rn/bookshow. You can download us as a podcast and you can find today's guest and book details there too. That's all from me, Ramona Koval, on ABC Radio National. Time now for the news.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.